Hi, everybody. How are you today? My name is Mark Chaffardini. I am the host of the Go See Talk podcast experience. And ha, hoo, ha, yeah, we have one hell of an episode ahead for you and your ears, and might hurt in the ribs a little bit, but I am about to speak to the two pillars of the House of Lawrence, House of Kreese, Dojo, whatever you want to call it. These guys have propped up Cobra Kai TV show and put it on a level that you would never would have expected. So we are thrilled to be speaking to these two masterminds, Crane kicking it, giving us everything they've got on drums, on violin, on guitars, mean shredding. So I'm going to quit rambling. I'm going to introduce Leo Bierenberg and Zach Robinson. Thank you so much for being on the show today, guys.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
That intro got me hyped.
Leo, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? What got you into music in the first place?
Oh, boy. Gosh, I was a band geek. that is my background. I played the saxophone. I was a very average saxophone player. I my day job was being a band geek, and then I moonlighted as a theater kid also. So in that vortex of insanity, my creativeness was born. I grew up in suburban Chicago. I did those extracurricular activities. I grew up in an environment that was very like pro music education in like a public school way, like basically just like a John Hughes movie setting. I don't know, like for a while, I like kind of wanted to be like a jazz guy. For a while, I kind of wanted to just like go study history. For a while, I like thought I'd go do some like musical theater acting. And then somewhere around the end of high school, I realized it was a lot more fun to boss everybody else around and tell them what to play rather than like sit and practice and play myself. So I ended up studying composition and music theory at NYU, which was honestly like mostly an excuse to like move to New York at first. And NYU's got an amazing film school, and a lot of my best friends right out of the gate were in the film program, and I started collaborating with them and was like, hey, this is like the greatest way to like bring all this the storytelling disciples to get like or disciplines together. Like, this is such a great outlet for creativity. And so after college, I moved to LA. I did a grad school thing at USC. And then I started working for a guy that it sounds like you know, named Tim Davies. And through Tim, I was introduced to Chris Beck and, started working for him for many years, which is where Zach and I met. And, none of us have worked together for a couple of years now, like 6 years. Actually, I did a documentary thing with Chris last year. It's kind of like a fun, like change of pace project. But that brings me here.
Well, that's awesome. You know, I heard that how Ramin Djawadi got his start is he just knocked on the back of Hans Zimmer's door. He must have answered an ad or something and just pretty much walked in the door, which sounds unheard of. So for you to graduate film school, composition school, come to Hollywood and be like, hey, and you know, Tim Davies kind of, he's a super, super secret weapon for composers out there. But like, is that a pretty easy path to success? Or do you just have to kind of like a bunch of musicians hanging around in the Guitar Center parking lot, hoping to get a freelance gig for some Hollywood project?
Definitely don't hang out in a Guitar Center parking lot.
I would second that too.
Like, I'd say that's like probably the last place you want to hang out. I'm also not sure I'd go knock on Hans Zimmer's door uninvited in 2021. I feel like I think it was less insane time back when Ramin made that knock. I don't know, Zach, like.
I think it is incredibly difficult, and there's a lot of
a lot of dumb luck.
A lot of just like a lot of dumb luck and a lot of like opportunity, a lot of right place at the right time. And then you've got to be kind of ready. On top of that, when you get that kind of way in, you have to be ready, because if you're not ready and you don't kind of give it your all, then there's someone right behind you who will. And I don't know if how much of the like cold call works as much anymore these days. I feel like it's normally like you need a reference or something, but hey, you never know. Like, you never know. Like, I think if to composers out there, like, you should, if you're interested in working somewhere, you might as well hit somebody up. Like, you know, composers read their emails like everybody else, I would assume.
Yeah. I think like you just got to put yourself in a position where you can meet people. Like, I actually think a really good job, if you like wanted to be a composer and didn't know where to start, is like go try to get a job like working at a recording studio in LA or something, where like clients are going to be coming and going, and you can like make like have conversations about your interests and like make connections, like, because the important thing, and anyone in who works in Hollywood will tell you this, it's not specific to composers, is like you just got to cast a really wide net and then follow up when you like naturally have some connections with people, and kind of the wider your net is, the wider your network will become, and that's what makes the world go round.
Gotcha. Well, I remember speaking to Steve Jablonsky, and he told me he got his start being basically a technician for Harry Gregson Williams, and he never intended to be a composer, but he was just sort of, you know, clicking around on the keys, and Harry said, you know, try some stuff, use my tools, and the next thing I know, he's one of the biggest names out there. So I guess there's something to that. But like Zach said, if you don't have the talent, well, yeah, good luck getting in the door in the first place.
Exactly.
That is true.
Well, you know, Zach, when we spoke, you said that, and it's great that you guys both studied composition and your paths were kind of, trajectory was kind of parallel to begin with, but you told me that there was a teacher that you had that said, don't let the external forces of consumerism define your sense as a composer. Sounds like really good advice, but if we can just segue into Cobra Kai and Karate Kid, do you guys have a Miyagi? Do you have a Kreese? Do you have a Silver that really gave you, you know, some, you know, tough but fair life lessons, and those are things you think about every day?
Wait, I also want to go back to this quote, this sage wisdom.
I know,
Zach share with me before.
Is that a quote?
I feel like
that
I need to learn this lesson.
I know. I feel like that quote was very well attributed. I don't know if I said that, but I must have. Can Chris be all three of those senseis, Leo?
Yeah, why not? the master of all the karate disciplines in one.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, like I would say we just came up, you know, the stuff that we learn, I have, you know, teachers from college that I hold in very high regard, and but I think just in terms of like film music and film scoring, there was no better masterclass or class in general than working for someone who's an A-list composer just working on big stuff, because you would get everything from, yeah, it's like, yes, you would work with like writing music to big name things, but you would also like be meeting people and learning how to act in front of like very big directors or executives from studios, and just like having FaceTime with those people and interactions, working with contractors, booking orchestras, all that stuff. You just learn that.
It's all part of the job. And it's all part of the job. Like if you're at a huge disadvantage, if you're like trying to, the gigs only get more and more complicated as your career goes on. And if you don't just like fluently know how to like work every part of the music production pipeline, you can get underwater really quick. I think what was like really beneficial about working for Chris in particular, and I know Zach shares this sentiment, is like, he is a really versatile composer himself. And also like, there are a lot of composers who are really versatile, but they get pigeonholed into one thing, so they don't get to be very versatile. And Chris, especially during the period that we were working for him, was like, every movie was totally freaking different. And man, what an awesome like learning ground, like what an awesome dojo to like hone your skills in, because like, one month we're working on like a Muppets movie, writing like one kind of music. And the next month we're working on like Edge of Tomorrow, which sounds totally different and involves like a totally different skill set. And the next month we're working on like a a Hot Tub Time Machine sequel, which is like totally different. And the next month we're working on Ant-Man. And it's like, we were like, he is just a really fortunate guy in that he gets to like do a lot of different types of projects. And I think that worked out really well for us as like learning how to do the job, because coming out of that, we were prepared for so many different types of challenges.
That's all. You guys are like Swiss Army knives in human form.
I
hope like, so.
Yeah, I hope so too.
Well, you know, I heard, I was listening to a podcast that, this is so strange, but talked about how kind of almost useless a college degree is. It's really just a way, most of the times you'll either learn things on the job, or sometimes you then know stuff before you get to college. I wasn't really paying attention, but how much of what you're learning, like on, you know, either in composition school or on, you know, on a soundstage or something, how much is that really in line with the things that you, I guess, wanted music to be when you first picked up a saxophone or a guitar? Was your mind, you know, paradigm shifted once you got to see how the big boys and professionals did it? Anything like that?
I actually disagree with whatever podcast that was with this opinion about college education, because I think there's like a surface level criticism to make for that kind of thing, where it's like, oh, like, you know, you go and you like learn your counterpoint and you learn your blah, 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 and you like never sit down and are like studying what like mode of counterpoint you're doing when you're writing a film cue. Like, that's totally irrelevant, but like, that's also like not why you go to college and study music. Like, it's much more has to do with an instrumentalist, which I am not, you know, don't consider myself, will tell you this especially, but like the reason you go to college and study music is to like develop like mentor relationships with like specific teachers who are like gifted academically. And like, I always think about like, I had a couple teachers who were really important in college, but two who were super important was one who I only studied with for one semester when I was abroad in Italy. He was an Italian composer named Riccardo Riccardi. And Riccardo Riccardi taught me the only way I could describe it is he taught me how to teach myself about music. Cool. Like in the way that he would assign me these things. Like I would go in and sit with him for 30 minutes or for 60 minutes. And the first 30 minutes, all he wanted to do was like, look at a Mozart piano sonata. And like, I'm not a good piano player by any means. And he would want to look at a Mozart piano sonata and then look at like a Mozart symphony and like compare the two. And then he'd be like, okay, Leo, when you come back next week, I want you to take this entire movement of like an insane amount of work. Like it take this entire movement of this Mozart piano sonata and orchestrate it like it's this Mozart symphony. And then I want you to explain to me why you did everything that you did. And I'd be like, oh, okay, fuck. Like, I guess that's what I'm going to do for the next like 7 days. And I would do this. And like, you learn so much about, I don't know, the nuts and bolts of like why music is constructed a certain way and why like you're making decisions and simultaneously analyzing why someone else made those decisions. And like, when I write film music, does it sound like Mozart? Usually not. But was that lesson really important for my decision-making process and like how I approach like composing? Like, yes. Or like another, like he would be like, okay, I want you to write like five different 16 bar builds that are all like these four bars in this Strauss piece. It's like a, you know, that exercise is somewhere on a hard drive and I've never looked at it since, but it's like the, I don't know, forging a relationship with someone who knows how to like challenge you and like work your muscles in a way that I think that's like why you go to an academic style learning experience. I think it's, and I think you can get those things out of like an on-the-job learning experience. I think that's very similar to the types of things that Zach and I did when we were working for Chris, or I was working for Tim before Chris. Yeah, I don't know where I'm going with this entirely, but the...
Well, I'll add on to your long-winded answer about this.
Yeah.
But the quick thing I'll say is that you don't go to college necessarily in regards to film composing. Like, you don't go to, you should not be going to college to learn how to film compose.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
You should be, yeah, yeah. Like, and the stuff that you learn from film composing is not the stuff you learn in college. And I don't even mean that from like a fundamentals perspective. I mean that from like, if you go to college to learn film scoring, you're not going to like listen to music. You're going to listen to film music. And like, that's not a good representation of like all the types of music in the world that like you need to be fluent in to film score. So like being with people from different backgrounds and having like that diversity of ideas and opinions and tastes are like really, really important. And I think that kind of gets lacked. Leo did an undergrad in composition and then did a master's program in film scoring. So he has that different background with like, you know, these very like organized like curriculums, so to speak, but I don't have that. I just did undergrad. So his perspective on that is unique for sure.
Well, did Ricardo teach you about facial grooming? Is that where you got that badass mustache?
No, he was very clean shaven. I had to teach myself how to grow a mustache this badass.
It is luxuriant.
Thank you very much.
Well, you brought up a good point about how you should be always expanding your palette. And I think, you know, as a novice musician, as a appreciator of music, I'm finding almost on a daily basis, like how deep the musical rabbit hole goes. I mean, when I go on Bandcamp, I'll just go down this, I'll find this, you know, drummer out of Zimbabwe, and I'll find this, you know, this drum and bass person out of London, all the things going on.
So overwhelming.
So sometimes when you work on a project, it's tough to see the forest through the trees, and you're on like Ant-Man has a very jazz heavy score and you just get in that jazz mode. I guess as a working professional, how hard is it to branch out and look for new music when you're constantly under a gun to deliver something that maybe one directional, if that makes sense.
Yeah, when everything sounds like One Direction, yeah. I totally get it. Like the band One Direction. It all comes down to like, I think if like A, the people you're working with will give you the opportunity to like explore and do stuff like that. I think if you're working like under a gun and you got to get something done really fast, then that's different. Sometimes it's easier to just kind of fall back on what everyone knows. And then sometimes you have someone who says, hey, I want this like cool experimental idea or this type of music. And then you do it and everyone changes their mind because it doesn't work to picture. So like that happens a lot too. Like it happens a lot. And it's, there's always this kind of like, I don't know what we would call it, Leo, but like the virgin composer, like starting on a new project and everything is so, you're so bright eyed and you're so ambitious. and then you write something and you send it in and they go, this is not working. And we should try something else. And then you slowly dip back into your old habits and
yeah,
and you're just like, no, I just gotta get this done.
That's because the most important thing to understand if you want to do film composing is that ultimately the job is not writing music. The job is rewriting music. That's not meant to be a like knock onto like the purity of the art form. What it means is that like you are not writing an album for your own pleasure. You are writing at the direction of one and many times many people who don't even agree with each other for like to create a musical score for their movie, of which you are also a collaborator and hopefully have an opinion if it's a good relationship. But you know, you might write 13 versions of something for a variety of reasons. And that's the real job. No one cares what V1 was. They care what's in the movie.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because not that I'm correlating your workload to my workload, but I work in hotels and architecture. And so there are so many times that, you know, it's like a watch. You can only fit so many things into a hotel room or a bar or something. And someone comes up with a crazy idea like, why don't you do it this way? But sometimes you just have to fall back on the stuff that works. Like the toilet goes here, your bed goes here. if you try to flip it around, it's just a waste of time and you have to follow the constructs, so to speak. But as you're advancing, let's just, you know, jump into Cobra Kai real quick. So you kind of set the stage with season one and you advanced some themes, you got some extended cues, and then you started, you know, at the end of season three and into season four, you started palette mixing. So where do the liberties come from once you have that foundation? And is it dangerous to go too far from the foundation?
I love the word dangerous. I think, well, Cobra Kai is the best of all possible worlds because we get a lot of leeway for what we can present. And therefore it gives us a lot of opportunity to like get high on our own scent a little bit and just like, oh, we've got this theme, we've got this instrument, like we haven't done that yet, like boom, like let's mash it up. And we do a ton of that in Cobra Kai, and because the structure of the show and the seasons is such that like the world and the lore of the like the in-show universe like expands with each season, and so we are constantly like bringing in these new things that get introduced and then like spinning them in with what we've already established, and you know, characters are like switching sides and teaming up or not teaming up or whatever, and it's like just this you know, everyone in the show is a shade of gray, which means that we can take whatever their theme is and kind of do it however we want, whenever we want, as long as like we see a narrative justification for it.
That's awesome.
And it's funny because there are definitely some things in season four which you'll see but you won't know, but like Leo and I were like, are we really going to get away with this? And we got away with it for sure. There's a few places we're like, I can't believe they actually approved this cue. So there's a lot, and every year there's like, we find more and more things, and it's, there's a level of trust between us and the showrunners that is unparalleled at this point.
But like the reason why we can get away with it, I would say, is because we're always kind of trying to like, we're not just like doing something for it to be like a joke when we're trying to say, can we get away with it? We're trying to like recreate a feeling that like brings nostalgia that can like, that could be parodied in other hands maybe, but in ours, like we're trying to sincerely like do whatever we're trying to do. And
right.
And so I think there's that, I don't know, something genuine.
That's a good way to put it.
Comes across. Yeah. It.
Well, you know, I remember the last time Zach and I were talking, Zach kind of has a an MO to not put more music in when this show can really ask you to really put the pedal to the metal. And sometimes when you put in too much music, it covers, you know, it becomes a crutch or covers some things that didn't work out. But, you know, I was watching Thief, Michael Mann's Thief, and Tangerine Dream has a fantastic score. Now, a lot of that feels like it's not hitting particular beats. I don't expect that maybe Michael Mann said, I need you to hit this on the face or whatever. It just feels like an acoustic blanket in a good way, laid over, kind of like a music video. And then I was watching License to Kill, the Timothy Dalton Bond movie, has a pretty spectacular ending with the trucks and the tankers. Mm-hmm. And it's surprising how little music is in that whole sequence when it's like one of the most spectacular elements of the Bond series. So I guess we know where Zach falls as far as placing music, but are you asked to really, you know, go outside your comfort zone and just throw music everywhere, or how do those discussions work?
Oh man, I mean, that's different on every project, really. Especially because like every filmmaker has their own taste with that, and kind of every project is kind of has its own set of storytelling rules that kind of organically develop over the course of the whole thing that way precede the composer usually, that will kind of inform like how you're going to make those decisions. I definitely am on, I share Zach's opinion that like, if you don't have to, you shouldn't be just like shoving extra music down people's throats. I think that composers, especially sometimes like less experienced composers, can get really like high and mighty on being like, no, like I gotta show the director like my scene with the music, because like I know that I know that story of when Hitchcock like said, don't score the shower scene. And then we scored the shower scene. And it's like, bro, you're not scoring the fucking shower scene. It's like this is, you know, it's a car crash. Like maybe they don't want music. Like there's, and maybe it's not, they don't want music. Like it's totally conceivable. It doesn't need music. Like filmmaking is a lot of different disciplines coming together. Like it doesn't always need music. And I think, you know, the less, if you pick and choose your moments more for like the best narrative impact, then the best narrative impact and like dramatic weight, then you are, I don't know, at making each spot more valuable when it does come in.
Mm-hmm. So the feedback from the fans and the universe is such that Cobra Kai is an amazing hit. And I'm going to say this nicely and fairly because you guys deserve it, but there's no reason the show and the music should be this good. It's like unbelievable. Like I find myself humming the themes, thinking about scenes from the show. And it's like, you know, it's described as a half hour comedy. And I'm going, why is this so impacting? So tell me why is there, can you lift under the hood and be like, that's it. This thing, right.
Why is it a half hour comedy is a good question.
As Zach says, the original sin of Cobra Kai is that it is a half hour comedy.
Yeah, because it's budgeted like a half hour comedy. So yeah. Like you think half hour comedies have to get orchestra on every single episode with like wall to wall music? No.
Yeah.
But I think but I will also say like the original idea of the show was that the showrunners Josh and Hayden like saw the scope of the Karate Kid as something so much bigger than just a story about a, you know, a kid learning karate in the valley. And to them it's their Star Wars, and they've always kind of had that idea that like this is the scope of the show, is that it gets this big. And in turn, like the music being as big as it is, both like sonically and kind of just like
thematically,
yeah, is that it makes the show funnier. I mean, not just funnier, but it makes it raises the stakes. It's a big reason why those stakes feel so big. And I don't know, in terms of like we're just psyched that like, again, as we kind of thought of that, we get to like write this stuff. Like we are just fans of like, we had so many ideas kind of when we first started, and all of those ideas have kind of like come to fruition in certain ways. And just big like 80s music heads, and you know, like we talked about like my old project EAD, and just coming from like that kind of world, it's been awesome that we've just been able to like approach the score the way we've been able to approach. And there were naysayers. There were people who said, you couldn't do it the way that we
did. Oh yeah. Like don't go 280s or they'll, you know, they'll never approve it. Like they, you know,
they'll never,
everyone says they want the 80s, but they don't get the 80s. But again, like, I don't know. I put that in the category of like, in some hands it's a parody, but in other hands it's like a genuine celebration,
right,
of not so much like we're trying to sound like the 80s, but we are literally trying to like execute from the same place the 80s came from. Like one thing that we always talk about is like the show, I mean, the show is so cinematic. It's much more like scoring a movie than it is like scoring what used to be TV, you know, you would consider like TV music. Those definitions are changing a lot, but you know, like the 80s as an influence, it doesn't just mean that we're talking about like hair metal and synthwave. It means we're talking about like the tradition of 80s movies that Karate Kid was born with this like soaring Bill Conti score, or like, you know, the entire freaking Amblin repertory from that time period. And all of those, like that, as an audience member, that type of scoring like carries you in a certain way. And it's highly thematic, and it just like makes you feel and like want to have fun and like want to like be a part of the universe. And so we're like always trying to tap into that too. And I think it goes back to some of what I was saying about just like approaching it with sincerity and like we're scoring. There's the show is very funny, but we're not trying to like score it to like make it funny by like overcharging it. We're just overcharging it, because like that's how 80s movies are created.
And
you know, we're trying to execute that in 2021 form, basically.
Well, there's an expression that goes, fake honesty and honest fakery. Now, I think that you guys fall in the latter category, because it feels nostalgic without being of the time frame. Like, it sits in and amongst the characters that were 25, 30 years ago, but it wasn't from that era. So in that respect, it fits perfectly. And, you know, I think that maybe the way that to describe why things are so, like, this is just the perfect time for it, because I got to imagine that, like, The Last Karate Kid was probably mid-90s, I think. And I think people who grew up with that are now at the age where they're wanting that and it's familiar to them. I think it's just perfect timing to where now they're consumers and there's a large amount of them. I mean, things like maybe the Cowboy Bebop revival that just happened, the new Matrix. It's like 20-ish years is a good amount of time to be like, hey, I saw this when I was five, now I'm 25, 35. Fucking give me more.
Yes.
Right. There's a lot of, I mean, you're digging into the stuff that like we were a bit younger for the Karate Kid generation, but you know, Power Rangers is now going to be an extended universe on Netflix.
Yeah.
That's so now we're going into the stuff, which, by the way, you know, obviously dream gig for me and Leo, but we like, you know, that's the stuff we grew up with. Like, you know, when we were 5 years old, like we were watching Power Rangers. And like that, so it's, but then of course what separates Cobra Kai from all of these is that it's just so, it's been hard for those other kind of like reboots or sequels or whatever to kind of gain as much kind of both like critical acclaim and also just commercial success. I think they really like struck gold. And we were always like, to kind of what you were saying about like, it's music kind of nostalgic of the time, but not of the time. I think that's like kind of how synthwave is too. Like you have synthwave where it actually doesn't really sound like the 80s, but it just sounds like what people remember the 80s as, and that's good enough. And we like to do that. We'd like to channel that. And I remember like Strike First, which is the very first thing when Johnny's beating the shit out of the teenagers in the first episode, we call that Cue Strike First. And that was our first moment of like, if we can get this kind of approved, that's like the thesis for like our statement. Like, this is the music that Johnny hears in, this is the music that Johnny hears in his head when he's beating up the kids. Mm-hmm. And now we're happy because it's the end credits. When everyone skips through the credits, that's the track. But
yeah, we hear bump, 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 bump. Oh, yeah. And then it's
gone. Next. Yeah, yeah.
Oh man, I just did an episode with some good friends about Cowboy Bebop, and that was the reason I brought that up. It's the same thing. There are times where the, you know, things are structured in a show such that it's all meant for maximum appreciation, and when you sort of undercut that, you know, it's like walking out of the theater during the credits. You know, you're not appreciating literally the bookends of this narrative or whatever it is. So it's kind of unfair that even exists. And man, don't even get me started on that like speed thing where you can play something at a time and a half or whatever.
Oh, it's horrible.
I'm sure Netflix will.
Well, you've had Daniel Pemberton on the show, haven't you?
I have. Yes.
He wrote an article about in the Guardian or something about how Netflix should get rid of their skip end credits.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, he was very happy to hear that I'm a big fan of the, he did that episode of Black Mirror, USS Callister. I was like, love that music. And he goes, you listen to it? It's like, yeah.
Hamilton's cool as hell. He's
good at everything.
Yeah. He's great.
Well, let me ask you, let's jump into the vinyl really quickly. This is a very special release. It's three seasons of music, not just done season 1, 2, and 3, like the La La Land CDs. You guys curated the list. Why don't you tell us about how this came together?
So what was most important to us was, if we were gonna do a vinyl, how do we make it feel specific to being a vinyl. Like, well, like it would be boring to just reissue the existing CDs on vinyl, do some cool artwork, even if it's really cool, and just call it a day. Like, that's lame. So we wanted to like create this collection that was a better vinyl listening experience. And in kicking around some ideas, we came up with this concept of like, well, what if we split it by the dojos? It's like the defining feature of the show. And so we came up with this. We've got, here's our Cobra Kai inspired music. Obviously, like the actual score is like a little harder to declare what's what, but it came pretty naturally. And then we've got the Miyagi disc, you know, two sides of Miyagi. And then we put all of our season finales for season one, season two, and then, you know, for everyone who's seen season three, there's basically like two giant finale fights. So both of those are on it. And those are all the moments where like the dojos are in the biggest conflict. So they're on this third, we call it the tournament disc.
Final fights.
The final fights. Yeah. And so that's kind of how we came up with the concept of it. Just trying to think like listening experience. And from there, we went down a lot of different roads of, we went into the whole art thing, which we can get into in a second because we're really into, but just like music wise, once we kind of curated the tracks, we did some new edits that we thought would flow better. And then we actually went back into the studio and recorded some extended versions of a couple tracks, like especially like some fan favorite ones where people are always hitting us up being like, hey, is there a longer version of Quiver? Like, especially Quiver. Everyone's just like, I need more Quiver to like, I got to work out to Quiver. And like, we want a longer Quiver too. And so we took the opportunity to give the world longer Quiver.
Sweet. So with a badass name for dojo, that's got an extended cue. Is that you playing the saxophone in that?
If only. That is the extremely talented Eric Marienthal, who I have worshipped since high school, and we had the opportunity.
Leo worships this guy, so Eric, so much that I remember I was like, do you want to write this email to him asking if he can play? And you're like, no.
I couldn't do it. he's like in LA. He's a session player in LA, and yeah, he's a fucking player. Monster. I mean, this guy is the king of like smooth jazz. Like, you gotta just look him up because the album covers will keep you entertained for hours alone. Like, they're so good. But the guy has the like just like next universe chops. I mean, he's insane. He's so freaking good. So yeah, for us, I mean, for us, Cobra Kai is always like a really, because the music's like fun and it's fun to play, like we're always just like looking for like fun new outlets and like collaborations like that whenever we have a chance to. And so yeah, do we get to extend our track and do like a long fade out sax solo with Eric Marienthal? Like, hell yeah, why not?
Great.
Like, why wouldn't you do that?
It's funny, every time I listen to this, I listen to it in its entirety, and I always come away with new favorites. And it's almost like the one I like the best is the one I'm listening to right now. Like, I just found a new appreciation for Chop Shop and Sam and Robbie, the extended. And it's just, they're so rewarding. But the question I have for you is that, you know, you can take it to a certain point. And when you lean on these session players, how do they contribute or make something better or give you an interpretation of something that you didn't see possible?
For as much as you go to composing school and learn about composing and stuff like that, you'll just never be able to write like the kind of sax licks that Eric Marienthal is going to play for you. And the same goes for, I'm thinking on Chop Shop, which is actually like one of my favorites. I love that cue. Like, I'm thinking on that one, our guitar player, Andrew Sinowick, he came up with there's like these diminished arpeggios that happen. If you're watching the show, it's like right when Johnny throws this wrench at this goon. We just love like goon fights. Like, we love, and that was the first fight, by the way, where Johnny and Daniel team up. That's like the best. Yeah. Like, we love that. Anyway, I have a sincere fondness for that piece of music. But we... it's, yeah, and the same thing actually goes for like another guitar player that we work with, Myron, who's played on tracks like King Cobra and Miyagi Metal. Like, we can give something to him and say, you know, I mean, I'll play like a scratch guitar on it, and he's way better guitar than me, but he also just like gets the style. And, you know, that's just something that you'll never be able to compose, or you'll never be able to mock up. And that is the benefit. It is one of the most rewarding experiences to like hear something that you wrote being played by like a professional at another level. And you're like, oh wow, like I can actually write something that can turn into it being cool and sound good. Like, wow, like I should do this more often. It is just a really rewarding experience to work with like the best musicians ever.
Well,
I concur.
Well, the fan base is
rabid,
out of this world, and rabid, and it's so great that they're so fervent. But you know. I know some people who do conventions and they bring in talent, like, you know, people who've been in Star Wars and Star Trek, but like when a property is so big, their reps, and a lot of people tell them, get used to talking about this for the rest of your life. So guys, are you prepared to talk about Cobra Kai for the rest of your life?
Honestly, yeah. I can't think of a world where I would ever not, like, you know, whenever Cobra Kai's story arc reaches its conclusion, like, it's going to be a really sad day, and I just can't imagine a world where I wouldn't want to talk about it at a minimum, because, like, you know, we're making a lot of memories here.
Well, great, we'll take this 1 hour podcast, we'll stretch it to 10. Let's just keep going. So side 7, track 22. No, I'm just kidding.
I thought you were gonna bring
yeah
it.
I was ready for a wild question.
No, I can't get any more geekier than to say this is a big thrill. I'm a moderate Karate Kid fan, I'm an even more of a Cobra Kai fan, but there's a musical competency that I don't have, other than to be like, this is pretty awesome. You guys rock. So,
I was going to throw out there really quick, just a shout out to our artist, Matt Ryan Tobin.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. We didn't talk about the art. And Zach, talk about the art.
The art is like, is the best part of the whole package. And we're obsessed with it. And I look at it all the time. But it's, talk about someone, like, we always like working people who we say get it, quote unquote. And Mondo gets it. And Matt Ryan Tobin for sure gets it. And like that, I mean, that the Cobra Kai cover was first round, first draft. Like,
The snake and with the fist, and like, oh my fuck.
The chrome snake. And we had asked for something, he had sent us that first, and we said, okay, can you do like the equivalent of that, but for Miyagi-Do? Doesn't mean 80s hair metal, but like, what is like going as far as your design for Cobra Kai, like, what does that look like in terms of Miyagi-Do? And he immediately, like, they sent us, him and Mo, who works at Mondo, sent us this like City Pop version of the Miyagi car, and I like threw up. I was so excited. Like, it was so unbelievable. And it is by far the thing, like, that we were just so thrilled we could work with these people on it, because it makes it. I mean, it just makes it. And Matt did the art for our upcoming album, which will be released, you know, when it's released, but he did our season 4 artwork. So, and it is as epic as the vinyl.
It is so awesome.
So does that mean, okay, so you at the, before we started recording, Leah was saying that I'm ready for season 5. So season 4 is in the can, and Zach, based on what you said, does that mean there's going to be a Mondo version, or is this La La Land, or how does this artwork find itself?
That I don't even know if we can say.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the plans are yet to be determined. There will be a season 4 album.
Okay.
There will be a season 4 album, and there is artwork.
Well, does the of all the artwork, what the hell's going on here, guys?
This was Mo's idea in Mondo.
He's holding up, for those who can't see, he's holding up our flyer, Learn to Fight, Join Cobra Kai flyer, which is a reference to in episode 103, season 1, episode 3, when Johnny is handing out flyers for Cobra Kai. We are mimicking
the Cobra pose. Guy himself. That's one of our favorite.
The Cobra Guy himself.
It's called Cobra Guy. And
yes.
And
so I'm interested.
It's also one of our favorite cues to play live. And I don't. Yeah, you got it. You can come. You can come to the dojo and plug some cables in, and then
see our fat dogs.
Yeah, see our fat dogs.
Well, Zach, can we go to the construct for a second? I've got a question about the Star Echoes. That's probably my favorite track on the whole album. The beginning, the part where he says, "As man, we're tied to the earth. We dream of the star." Is that from a movie, a book? Where does that come from?
It's from the first short that I ever scored, called Telescope. And it's just an it's not like, I can send you the link. It is a, it's a short film. You might like the short film. It's awesome. It's a beautiful movie, but they, I just grabbed that line because I was right. I actually think part of Star Echoes, that song, was a thrown away cue from Telescope. So talk about throwing stuff away all the time, but it turned into something good because it turned into the AD. Same with the first track, Farthest Reaches, was supposed to be a cue in this short film called Telescope, and ended up on the cutting room floor. And then I just took it and put it as the DAD starter.
Oh man, that's a
yeah.
Well, great bookends. But there's something about that was so. I mean, you said that you've been. I'm not laughing because it's funny, but you said you read in articles that you're described as a synthwave pioneer, which is pretty badass title to have. But I just like what that gave to the album, especially on the tail end of it, just to sort of send it into the
stratosphere. Thank you. I know people ask about DAD stuff, and it's kind of like, I kind of get that release through Cobra Kai. Like I find that, and we're just so busy all the time, but it's, I don't find the need to write as like DAD because I just feel like it's turning into Cobra. Like it's just that. Like Slither is like a DAD track, or I feel like I get that type of release from those types of things. But maybe there will be one day.
Well, if I'll cross.
I am always telling Zach that it's time for the next DAD album. I feel like I'm constantly saying this.
Yeah.
Well, here's where my musical, I'm going to get geeky. There's a part in Star Echoes that sounds like those little clickers that are on a bike that goes you know, like, what was that sound, and how did you achieve it?
I'm not sure what the ticker tickers are. I'm not sure, dude. It could have been a hi-hat. It could have been like a 16th note hi-hat. It's crazy because like writing that stuff, I wrote that stuff when I was in college. Most of that stuff, I was like in school. It was so long ago. And I think it's also on like, before I even knew how to use the software that like Leo and I use every day. Like it's so, I listen to it now and I'm like, oh dang. Like there's stuff that holds up for me, and there's a lot of stuff that does not hold up for me in terms of production and like whether I would have done that now or not. But it's wild to have something that like, I mean, it's almost been 10 years. I think it's been like 8.5 years since that album came out. But yeah, there's stuff on that album that I wrote in like 2010. Like it was a long time ago for me, for sure. So I apologize if I don't remember.
That's okay. Well, the point is it's aging well and people appreciate it.
Thank you.
NPR's best cassettes of 2013, right?
Yeah, that was a highlight.
Well, Leo,
I had met Leo relatively recently to that. I like came into the studio and I was like, hey guys, like to Leo and Chris and who else worked there, and I was like, hey, my cassette it was best of 2013 NPR, and everyone was like, what?
Oh well, speaking of cassettes, the Mondo vinyl came with a cassette, and it's still in the shrink wrap. I'm gonna let it age gracefully on my shelf. Nice. I don't have anything that plays that type of musical apparatus, but so you guys do so well together, yet you have separate studios. Can you talk about the, separate but equal, and you know, what you're working on when it's not dojoing?
We have separate studios, but our setups are very, very similar because we both trained at the dojo of Beck and kind of built our systems, which are no longer the same as his systems, but they're, you know, from the knowledge we accumulated
from the same school.
What worked for us. And so we have a pretty easy time trading files back and forth, and we do that a lot. You know, we just pass cues back and forth until they are satisfactory to us, and then call it a day. But we kind of do this. I don't know what our percentage actually is, but I feel like it's like a 60-40. Like we do 60 of our own stuff, and then our other like, or 30, our other 33%, or our other 40% is like our combined Zach and Leo brand. And I think like, it's actually amazing to me that like more people don't do this, because it's like so creatively rejuvenating to like have like your own time and your own project, and then you're like collab with Zach time, and like that's its own thing, and like the workflow is totally different, the way like the just like the kind of music you come up with is different, because you're like because you're kind of in like conversation the whole time while you're coming up with ideas. It's not just like, oh, I'm gonna like work on it and then present it. You're like, I don't know, it's a lot more there's just like a lot more discussion like during
it's
the writing
not
process.
And it's not as lonely, like
it's, yeah,
it's not
as
lonely
being
job.
A composer can suck so much, like you're just alone in a room all the time.
it's just wild though that like, sorry Leo, go.
Oh no, you go.
I was gonna add that it's just like Cobra Kai somehow takes up like our full year all the time, whether we're like this morning, like we're working on separate stuff right now, but like we had to like talk about all this Cobra Kai stuff this morning, because there's just always, whether it's like the show, we're working on the show, or it's next season, or it's an album release, or we're doing our extended versions, you know, there's just like always something to talk about with this show. Or like, you know, we're planning on live performances next year, and like there's just like always something, and it's just wild how it just like it's like a full year gig sometimes.
It's got to be a good problem to have. I mean, you know, you've got an embarrassment of riches as this wonderful album that nobody can see because that I'm holding up. But it is, you guys keep rocking, you keep knocking it out of the park. Really curious to see how seasons 4, 5, and 6, I've heard that's sort of the end of the road for from John, Josh, and Hayden has said. Is that right?
We don't know like what the actual plan is, and we also like don't read scripts or anything, so we like we go in cold, like when we go in cold. Like when we start to score an episode, it's like the first time we've watched it almost always, so we're like really reacting to it. But they have said in a lot of interviews that at least like in their initial concept they kind of had this like 6-season arc, but I don't know if they're like sticking to that, and like, you know, they're very non-committal in any answer to whenever anyone tries to see into the crystal ball, they quickly can cloud the crystal ball in often hilarious ways.
But they're shooting
my favorite, we like watched them on a panel once, and like someone in the audience, it was like at Comic-Con or WonderCon, and like somebody in the audience got up and was like, blah, 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 blah. Like, I think this was before season 3. So someone's like asking about like, oh, when's Allie Mills coming back? Or like one of the questions that if you're the creator of Cobra Kai, you've heard like thousands of times. And John just like gets onto the microphone and is like, we are aware of all of the characters. and it's like, and like, I forget what his follow-up to that was, but it was like so, I mean, it brought down the house. It was so funny.
It was very funny. So yeah, we are aware of all characters past and present in the Karate Kid universe. Like, let us do our
like,
thing.
Yeah, like you like, don't have to remind us they exist.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
And there's a lot of that now. I mean, there's so much, like, I mean, they've only just begun to, like, you know, bringing Allie back was really the icing on the, I mean, or it was the first layer.
Well, parting is really such sweet sorrow. You guys are amazing to talk to. I love chatting with you. Last question before we sign off. If you could go to the set, you probably have already gone to the set. Is there a prop or something that you just would be happy if it disappeared and ended up in your house?
I was going to say take a training lesson with their like stunt coordinators.
Yes.
Because we've been offered that and we were like, oh shit. Like, they shoot in Atlanta and we live in LA. So we've never been there. Hopefully we could get there by the end of it. That's a good question though. For like a physical object.
Yeah.
I think I'd steal the Medal of Honor.
I was going to say the Medal of Honor as well. I would be down with some of the like ancient Miyagi-Do relics.
The scrolls.
Yeah. The Shinpo Sensei scroll.
Yeah.
Love the crane technique. Yeah. That's pretty great. Oh, that is a great moment. Thinking of crane technique. We love
this. This is not for you. That's so the best one. Like, what do you
take? I know. Yeah.
This is not for you.
Like they so literally good. Like they retcon the idea of his like crane move that he does at the end of the first movie. They retcon it into like an ancient scroll tech, like that he finds. It's just so genius. I love it.
Oh man, I don't know if it would ever fit in my house, but one of the billboards that says "We kick the competition" that might be.
Oh yeah, that's a good. Oh yeah, that's a good one.
Oh yeah. Well, it's probably digital anyway, so.
Yeah.
Well, guys, why don't you take us out? Why don't you tell us where can audiences and fans find your stuff?
I'm at Zach Robinson on Twitter, at ZRobUSA on Instagram. It's the best way to find me.
I'm at Leo Berenberg on Instagram and also Twitter. And Instagram is probably the better way to find me. And, you know, you can find all of our music on Spotify and Apple Music and in physical form at La La Land Records and Mondo Records.
Well, guys, it has been a treat. Everyone support these pillars of the dojo so that they can keep doing what they do. Otherwise, they're going to come to your house and kick you so hard you'll see the curvature of the earth. Guys, beautiful. It has been a pleasure. I hope to chat soon, and we'll catch you next time. See you, everybody.